Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have CFR President Richard Haass with us today to discuss his new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. Dr. Haass has been President of the Council on Foreign Relations since 2003. From January 2001 to June 2003, Dr. Haass was Director of Policy Planning for the U.S. Department of State, where he was the Principal Advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Confirmed by the U.S. Senate to hold the rank of Ambassador, he served as U.S. Coordinator for Policy to the Future of Afghanistan and was the U.S. Envoy to the Northern Ireland Peace Process. He was also Special Assistant to President George H.W. Bush, Senior Director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the staff of the National Security Council, and is the author or editor of 12 books on American foreign policy. Additionally, Dr. Haass is the reason why we have the Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative here at the Council, which he launched in 2006, so we are grateful for that. Richard, thanks very much for being with us today. You begin the book by talking about, this is a book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, You Never Imagined Writing. It would be good if you could start by telling us what compelled you to write this book and what you see as the biggest threat to U.S. security and our prosperity here in America.
Okay, well, thank you, Irina, and let me thank everyone who's on the line. And let me just take 30 seconds to say how important this larger initiative is, the Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative is to us, and we hope that you will look to us as a resource throughout the year on questions of American foreign policy and international relations. Irina asked me to start off, which is why is it that the President of the Council on Foreign Relations is writing a book with the somewhat unexpected, if not heretical, title of Foreign Policy Begins at Home. What got me to this was really two sets of developments. Both took place over a decade or a decade and a half. One was external, essentially the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I found myself increasingly questioning the wisdom of both wars. Just to be clear, I had questions about the Iraq War from the onset, even though I was in the administration at the time. And while I supported the Afghan War initially, when I thought it was a war of necessity to in the aftermath of 9/11, I came increasingly to doubt the wisdom of the United States tripling its force levels in Afghanistan and essentially expanding its war aims. When I looked at both wars together, I concluded that the United States had overreached abroad and in many ways in the process had overlooked local realities, historic realities, cultural realities, religious realities, and more in trying to remake these societies. The second set of developments which led me to write this book were a little more domestic. And essentially, to cut to the chase, the increasing dysfunction of our political system. And there were any number of challenges out there. You all don't really need me to detail them, but the challenges of our K-12 education, the challenges of inadequate, in many cases, crumbling infrastructure, the inability to pass comprehensive immigration reform, which meant both that we were not getting the best and brightest from around the world to come and stay here, but it also meant that 11 to 12 million men, women, and children were living in the shadows, so to speak, of American society. I was also extremely worried by the long-term entitlement challenge, the fact that there were looming obligations that it was and remains predictable we would be unable to meet, and also that we have been growing economically over the last 5 years or so at a rate roughly a half to two-thirds of the historic post-World War II average. And in all of these cases, what I thought was the problem was less the absence of specific reforms, but more the inability of the political system to come together and work out agreements which would reflect a degree of compromise. So since I am in the ideas business, I therefore embarked on writing this book, which I did. And what I've called for, to use my favorite word, is restoration to become the new doctrine of national security for the United States. It would embrace both foreign policy and domestic policy, national security being more intensive than either. And what it would do is essentially restore certain balances to U.S. public policy. On one hand, it would restore the balance between foreign policy and domestic policy, moving it somewhat in the direction of the latter. And that would mean that a greater percentage of our resources would be devoted to what we to the challenges here at home. It would also restore balance within foreign policy, and would bring to an end an era in which I believe the Middle East has absorbed simply too many of our resources, be it defined as money or our military or lives or simply the attention of policymakers. And we would scale this back to some extent. At the same time, we would scale up some other foreign policy challenges, our efforts dealing with the evolving situation in the Asia-Pacific, where many of the world's largest economies and great powers are beginning to interact in ways which has the potential to become unstable, but also put a greater emphasis on North America, where the United States, Canada, Mexico are on the cusp of realizing what could be an extraordinary, not just improvement in their energy picture, but also in their economic reality in a way that this part of the world could actually become the engine for much of the rest of the world. So again, these are two rebalances in principle, one within foreign policy and one between foreign and domestic policy. I argue further that there is the opportunity to do this, like the sort of, on the scale, say, of Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan in the first part of the 20th century or the Soviet Union during the four decades of the Cold War. So that while there are any number of threats and challenges abroad, from North Korea to Iran to situations like Syria to climate change to poverty, what have you, none of these is existential, and all of them give us a bit of time and space to focus on things here at home. And I also argue that there is not just opportunity, but rather that there's necessity, that unless we put our house in order here at home, we're not going to be in a position to lead the world well into the 21st century. Just to be clear, this is not an isolationist track. Again, I am the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. I've devoted my entire professional career to thinking hard about matters of foreign and defense policy. I've worked for four presidents. But rather, it is my sense that U.S. strategy requires us to make choices to determine priorities. And this means that we have to make some choices in what we do abroad, and it means we have to make some choices in what we do at home as opposed to doing abroad. Or to put it another way, we cannot do everything everywhere every time. This also doesn't in any way reflect a pessimistic or so-called declinist view of the future of this country. I'm quite bullish on America. Indeed, what has happened in the energy realm over the last few years reinforces and capacity for innovation remains great, but again, things just don't happen automatically. I don't know if we will turn things around and put our house in order. I don't have any crystal ball. I am not in the predictions business. I would simply say that the stakes are big, that if the United States does put its house in order, it would have the capacity to act and lead in the world. It would be able to discourage the emergence of a great power rival. it would be able to deal with one if it were to happen all the same. And the stakes are big in another way. In my view, there simply isn't an alternative to American leadership. Let me be clear on that. I'm not arguing for unilateralism. I think there must be multilateralism as the mechanism for acting in the world. But I simply don't see any other country that has the mixture of capacity and inclination and history and habits to play a global leadership role. So the alternative to a U.S.-led world is not a China-led world or a Russia-led world or a Japan-led world or a Europe-led world or an anybody-led world. To me, it's a world that would not be led, and that to me is a dangerous world. That's a world of greater conflict and reduced prosperity and reduced tolerance and reduced freedom. And what I have therefore tried to do in this awfully complicated world, which I've not described at length, but a world of ever more distributed power in a world where obviously global forces are increasingly provide an intellectual framework to help Americans in and out of government, throughout society, to essentially navigate this world, to figure out what should be our priorities, what is it we should do and where we should do it, and just as important, how is it we should do it. So why don't I stop there? Since I call for political reform, I will not practice a filibuster. And instead, why don't we open it up for an exchange here?
Terrific. Thank you very much. Taylor, let's open up to questions and comments from the group.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the question queue, press star 2. Again, please press star 1 to ask a live question now. Our first question comes from Jim Campbell with Chinchaga Institution.
Okay. Question?
It looks like they disconnected. I'll go to the next question. And our next question is from Charles Stromer with the Center for Public Justice.
Perfect.
Okay, thank you, Richard, very much. I guess I get to start then.
This is like sitting in the front of the church.
Sorry?
This is the equivalent of sitting in the front pew.
Yes, yes, which I never try to do. I leave that to the big angels to protect the preacher. I've just finished reading your book. It's really quite good. I appreciate it. I think we all on this call and many others appreciate someone of your caliber writing a book like this, as you say, daring to. It's certainly been on a lot of our minds for a long time, America getting its own house in order. And you're pretty general in the book, and I understand why. I'm wondering if you could talk about some specifics maybe, because I'm thinking I've been working for a long time on this initiative called the Wisdom Project, which is about bringing people that hold the different ideologies together on common ground, kind of setting aside their rigid ideological views, bringing them together on common ground to sort of work out some issues, especially between the U.S. and the Middle East and some of the bad situations there. But maybe if you could give us, like, you know, I like it that you're using the word wisdom a lot in the book and you've used it in this conversation a bit. Could you give us like some specific ideas or specific incidents that you are sitting there at the top of CFR have seen, like maybe where the U.S. has sort of not sort of been first among equals necessarily, but listened to maybe some allies or maybe even some partners or maybe others over in the Middle East that have taken some cues from that, and you thought, hey, that's pretty wise, you know, let's maybe adjust our policy a bit, or our analysis and our prescribing, and go with that rather than what we thought in Washington might be the way to go. I think some specifics like that might be pretty good to hear, and I hope I'm making some sense there.
I'll try. Look, the Middle East is a hard part of the world to come up with examples where, at least in recent years, I would argue the United States has gotten things right. But 20-odd years ago, when the United States led the international response to Saddam Hussein's invasion and occupation of Kuwait, And I thought we were entirely right to say from the get-go, as the former president said, the 41st president, that this would not stand. We then marshaled an extraordinary international response, really unprecedented. We then got national as well as international support for doing what we did. We didn't rush it. We gave the Iraqis a more than generous amount of time to meet fully and unconditionally the various UN resolutions. They refused to. And only then did we intervene with military force. And then we didn't go beyond the boundaries, if you will, of what we had undertaken to do. There was, if you will, either an implicit or an explicit or both understanding with the international community about the limits of what we would do. And there was also a healthy respect for the realities of Iraqi society. And for all those and other reasons, we didn't quote-unquote march onto Baghdad, but we limited what it was we did. So I think that to me was something of a well considered and then well of foreign policy. I also think at times the United States has been a critical actor in promoting peace between Israelis and Palestinians, as well as between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan at other times. And in several instances, the efforts only succeeded because of American diplomatic help. And then in the last two instances where the United States did a great deal, first under the Clinton administration and then under the George W. Bush administration, things didn't obviously all work out, but it wasn't for a lack of American effort. Again, it shows that while the United States can lead, it cannot insist or impose. Why don't I leave it at that? Otherwise, I could probably use up the rest of our time answering this one thoughtful question alone.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul Rutgers with the Council on Religious Leaders, a Metropolitan of Chicago.
Thank you. First of all, thank you again for that summary, and I feel that very strongly here in Chicago because in many respects it seems to me to summarize the aura that's hanging over a religious table that brings together a remarkably large number of very diverse faith leaders. And as over the years we've dealt with national and international issues, which not primarily our purpose here, there has been an increasing apprehension or concern about the steps that we're having to support or at least tolerate here. And I'm in this context then wondering, together with urging that your book be read, if I hope that wasn't me.
No, yeah, we still hear you.
Yeah, okay, good. Other than, as I say, getting out the book into the hands of our members, if there are any specific things that you feel that an organized religious community can begin to address in fostering your concerns?
That's a big question. I think we face reality. I haven't been asked that question before, so I'm answering it as I'm thinking about it. But I think you all face a challenge, and we all face a challenge, which is that there's almost a certain contradiction. That here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and the ability of the world to affect the United States for better and for worse is manifest, and vice versa. Even though we're only 4-plus percent of the world's people, or 20 or 22% of the world's economy, again, there's lots of areas where we have great opportunities to affect the trajectory. That this is all happening at a time where Americans know less about the world than ever before. Our schools, for the most part, aren't teaching it. One of the unintended consequences of all this emphasis in many cases on teaching the basics, whether it's reading, writing, thinking, and the rest, math. For the record, I'm not against teaching any of those basics. one of the unintended consequences is that there's been a certain squeeze or crowding out of time and effort and resources that in the past would have been devoted to what in my day they called civics or social studies. You're also seeing it with the media, that the major networks and newspapers are giving less space to international coverage. And even where that's not the case, fewer and fewer people are watching the nightly broadcasts or reading the major newspapers. Instead, people are going to this or that website that tends to showcase the issues they're most interested in, few of which have anything to do with the world. And in most public opinion polls, interest in or emphasis in the world is extraordinarily low. So I would think that there's a, I'm not sure if the word's opportunity or necessity or both, but I would think that religious organizations have both an opportunity as well as a certain obligation to educate those who are members about the world. It could be the fundamentals of education. There's also an element of advocacy in many instances. But in the first instance, I would really think it's simply to make the case that what goes on, favorite expression, which may or may not be appropriate in this group, but the world is not Las Vegas. What happens there doesn't stay there. That Americans, again, are affected on a daily basis by what goes on over seas. And also that Americans have the ability, I think, to still do tremendous good in the world. And there's got to be a moral and ethical, if you will, purpose to what it is we do in the world. And I say this as someone who's normally described as a realist. But whether it's trying to keep the peace or deal with global challenges like disease or climate, I think there's a lot of potential purpose to be introduced into American foreign policy. And I just think the people on this call and people you work with and people you know have a real chance to fill a large gap that has emerged in American society, which is simply knowledge of and awareness of and consideration of what is going on in the world and what is it we should do either as a country or as a community or as individuals. One doesn't only have to write your congressman, but there are ways that churches and synagogues and mosques can do important things directly. One way to think of religious organizations are as NGOs, and they can organize efforts in many ways in the field. They can organize educational efforts. They can organize humanitarian efforts for their congregants, for their members. So I just think there's a tremendous need and opportunity alike for people in this field to help fill what's increasingly a void.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Next question or comment.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Nancy Berg with George Washington University.
I'm really looking forward to reading the book. And also I like your term restore. My question is about leadership. And it sounded like you were talking about a little bit of a pullback, at least for a while we get our domestic situation restored. And I wondered if there's a timetable for that. And what we would retain during leadership, or what is the framework for thinking that through and for the public debate about it?
Pullback's a bit strong. I mean, the model I like to use is adjustment or dial, or for those of you who tinker on weekends, rheostat as opposed to switch. But that there ought to be, as I said, two rebalancings. One is within the world of foreign policy, somewhat away from a Middle East-centric foreign policy. It doesn't mean we abandon the Middle East, but it does mean redirected efforts. For example, I would not be heavily involved in the situation in Syria, and a slightly greater effort in places like Asia, where I think we do have tools that could make an appreciable difference. I would still be, have a robust defense budget. To me, always more important than how much we spend is how we spend it. put something on the order of what we're spending now, whether it's $475 billion or something like that, or a little bit more or less, seems to me entirely reasonable given the role the United States plays in the world, that kind of a core defense budget. What we spend, we no longer really spend on Iraq, and what we spend on Afghanistan will fade over the next year and a half most part, and we can sustain that level of defense spending. It's actually relatively modest in terms of a percentage of federal spending or GDP compared to historical rates. You know, how long really depends upon two things. One is how well we use this time. If we are somewhat efficient, Nancy, about putting our house in order, and we, for example, were to restructure our long-term obligations on entitlement, we could do that in a week. It wouldn't kick in for, in many cases, for 5, 10, or 15 years, but as long as we locked it in, that would be the biggest single thing we could do. There's many other things we could do to promote economic growth. Most, by the way, would not require large amounts of new money. Infrastructure modernization, for example, would require very little new money. Most of it would be done through public-private partnerships. It would take years to actually do. But, if you will, it wouldn't require a long time out. And I'm not suggesting that the United States somehow retire or withdraw from the world. We don't have that luxury. But also there's no need to that. We've got to be able to stay involved in the world. At the same time, we address the challenges at home. I'm just simply saying that to the extent, particularly for political figures, as well as to some extent for the marginal resource for that last dollar, so to speak, then I would say, yeah, for the next few years, the emphasis ought to be at home until we do what we need to do at home or until the situation abroad changes. There could be a situation where suddenly I could be wrong in my assessment of China, say, and the Chinese could begin to emerge much sooner as a more adventurous country. I doubt it, but it's possible. But if it were to happen, the United States could dial up its response in Asia. But my own sense is we have, again, a pretty healthy breathing space. And the real question is not how much time we have, but how well we were to use it.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joseph Paul Martin with Barnard College.
Thank you very much. Obviously a very interesting discussion, but just quickly, my question is about public debate, because one of the things I find rather frustrating, and it comes up frequently, are two sort of trump cards, and there are obviously many others. One is obviously simply the word national security, so somehow or other there's a sort of a holy item there that can't really be touched, and of course we on the outside can't really know. And the other one is the need to support our troops. So these are sort of trump cards, which I think, how do we deal with those in terms of maximizing public debate in this country?
I missed the first one. I'm sorry. The second one was to support our troops. The first was?
Simply the word national security.
I see.
They use quite often, obviously.
Yeah, the question of national security, the real question then is, is how you define it. I think we're all in favor, Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike, all of us, whatever our field, are in favor of the nation's security. To me, that goes without saying, but that's the beginning of the conversation, not the end of it, and that's where reasonable men and women, or in some cases unreasonable men and women, disagree. And that, I tend not to, let people hide behind slogans like that. The question of support for troops is, obviously we support the troops. The men and women who serve this country risked their lives, and 6,500 gave up their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan with serious injuries of one sort or another. So you always support the troops. What I think you need to do is make a distinction between supporting the troops and not necessarily supporting the policy. And in my experience, the troops understand the difference. I spend time with them out in the field. I visited them both as a government official and as a civilian. The troops don't have the luxury, if you will, on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis of questioning the policy. They're too busy carrying it out and staying alive and looking out for themselves and the person on either side of them. But they understand that there's policy debates, and they appreciate at times that people can disagree with the policy and obviously mean well for them. Indeed, that's one of the areas our society has evolved in a positive way since Vietnam, where quite honestly at times it was extraordinarily unfair and I think wrong, where people disagreed with the policy and at times took it out on the individuals who were implementing it. And one of the good things about America over the last 10 or 15 years, I believe, is that we've now, most if not all Americans, have learned that they can and should support the individuals in the field, even if they take issue with the substance of the policy itself. So when people speak and write about it, sometimes you have to make this you make that clear, and I often do when I disagree with the policy. But I do think it's we as citizens, and I believe that's an important part of patriotism. It's an important part of citizenship. So when I disagree with the policy, I disagree with it in what I hope is a responsible and constructive way. And I, whenever given the chance, in case anybody wonders, I make it clear in no way does that diminish or contradict the sacrifices of the men and women involved in carrying out the policy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Satpal Singh with the World Sikh Council.
Hi, thank you very much for touching on this really important issue. I have a concern and a question. My concern is that there is a lack of clear thinking on important issues, on complex multidimensional issues. Rather than thinking in a simple linear way, we need to be able to analyze the issues from various angles before launching into major initiatives, whether at the international or the domestic level. A related aspect is that our educational system is focusing less and less on developing such critical thinking capability, and in difficult fiscal times, education becomes one of the first targets. Condoleezza Rice, along with Chancellor of the New York City school system, headed a task force, and they said that the status of our education is a great national security issue itself. So this is my concern, and the question relates to the time frame that we discussed a few moments ago. Is there a possible tipping point if we further lose our credibility in the world, beyond which it would become difficult to restore our status and role in the world? And thank you again for a great introduction to the this important subject.
Well, thank you. I'm also a great believer in clear thinking, certainly before you act, but also while and after you act. I used to say that you've got to analyze policy before you implement it, but it's also important to continue to analyze policy while you are executing it, and then afterwards. You should constantly revisit policy with as much intellectual rigor as you can imagine, and all I can say is I'm not saying I do that. I simply say I do the best I can, and I try to push this institution and everyone associated with it to do the best that he or she can. On the question of our educational system, as I noted before, I'm concerned that our educational system is not preparing America as a highly competitive global world, but also is not preparing them as citizens. It's not clear to me how an individual can fulfill his or her obligation as a parent or as a neighbor or as a voter if he or she is not somewhat aware of what is going on in the world and some of the considerations and choices that face this country. So if our education, if our formal educational system isn't going to do it, isn't going to provide it and require it of its students, then we're going to have to find ways to complement or supplement that educational system. The reason we brought that task force into existence that you mentioned on K through 12 education was to urge our educators, but also those in a position to influence them, including parents and local governments and authorities, to look at the content of our education. And that gets into two things. One is skills, and you mentioned critical thinking. So to look at our, you know, what we do to encourage our young people to think critically, to analyze, to write, to speak, to articulate well, to read with high comprehension. So I think there's that set of educational pursuits. And then there's the question of content. What is it we want our students to know? What is it we think they need to know about this country's history, about this country? About other cultures, about certain, again, pieces of history. And that's a conversation that we intend to promote. I don't claim to have the answers here, but I do think that, again, we as citizens and we as a society and we as participants or leaders of the society need to think hard about what is it we teach in our schools? What is it we teach outside our schools? What is it we make available so our citizens can be ready to deal with all the challenges that are going to come their way? And you know, I, for one, can think of few more important areas to focus on.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Leonard Rogers with Global Initiatives. Mr. Rogers, your line is now live.
Maybe we should go to the next question.
Thank you, Ms. Bastianos. It looks like Mr. Rogers has disconnected. And our next question comes from Mustafa Al-Qasimi with the Islamic Information Center of Orange County.
Yes, Dr. Haas, congratulations on your new book. In the outset of your presentation today, you said you questioned the wisdom of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I want to know your opinion now on what is happening in Syria, especially in the light of the continuous atrocities committed not just by the regime in Syria, but also by the Al-Nusra Front and the Al-Qaeda affiliates who are fighting on the ground in Syria. Is our government going to help such rebels to control power in Syria and ultimately in the region? So please, I'd like to hear your views on this.
Sure. Well, thank you for asking. It's obviously on the short list of both the most urgent but also most complex foreign policy decisions or issues facing the United States at this time. Let me answer it in two ways. One is coming back to the arguments of my book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home. I believe the United States cannot ignore the Syrian situation, but I also believe there needs to be a limit to how much the United States gets involved, and there's two reasons why. First, Syria is not the only concern the United States has in the world at this moment or in the foreseeable future. Or to use something of a cliche, it is a square on the chessboard, but it cannot become the entire chessboard. We've got to look elsewhere in this region. We've also got to look at what goes on in the Asia-Pacific. We've got to think about Africa, Latin America, and we've also got to think about challenges here at home. Secondly, in addition to that set of calculations, we also have to ask ourselves, whatever it is we likely result. And I would simply say that one of the things we ought to have learned in places like Iraq and Afghanistan is that doing more, especially militarily, doesn't always produce more in the way of positive results. But given the nature of these struggles, particularly civil struggles within societies, it can be extraordinarily difficult for outsiders to play a productive role in a way where the results are in any way in line with what it with what is invested in the way of money or military arms or human life. In the case of Syria, then, where does this lead me? I would say that the United States is right to be doing all it can to help the refugees and the internally displaced persons. So whether they stay within Syria or go across the border into Jordan or Turkey or wherever, the United States ought to be extraordinarily generous in helping these men, women, and children. More broadly, we ought to do what we can to see that the war does not spread beyond Syria into places like Jordan and Turkey, conceivably Lebanon, and also Iraq. We ought to discourage others, though I'm a realist in this, from continuing to do what they are doing. Obviously, little or no influence there. We also wish that Russian policy were quite different, though again, it's not clear what, if any, influence we'll have there. But there's no reason as yet to totally give up on diplomacy. I think the big questions for foreign policy are what is it we do more directly, and I'd say there's two issues. One is, should we be providing assistance to the Syrian opposition more than we are currently doing? And I heard what you said about elements of the opposition have agendas that we cannot support. That is true. On the other hand, there are still elements of the opposition that have agendas we could support. And I think with those elements, we should be willing to provide all forms of support, including so-called lethal support. Though, again, we ought to be careful about what we're giving to whom. I do not think, though, that we should under normal circumstances, be prepared to get involved directly militarily ourselves for the reasons I articulated before. I simply am not confident that we should do that given all else we have to worry about, and also given my own assessment of Syria, what would be the consequence of the United States using military force directly. The one partial exception I would probably draw is if the Syrians were to use chemical weapons and it was clear that they were using it, then I can imagine so-called punitive or punishment strikes against select targets in Syria. Certainly any officers or those who ordered their use, and I would try to do that in a way, say, using so-called standoff weapons, cruise missiles, and the like, so that American personnel were not endangered.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lonnie Valentine with the Aram School of Religion.
Hello. I have a question with regard to how you see the role and the immorality, I would put it, of transnational corporations in your whole scenario. I was very surprised in reading the Time magazine article and the introduction of the book that you didn't mention the role of transnational corporations at all, when one could say that we are now seeing in our domestic policy the victory of the transnational corporations in controlling our government and the damage it's doing to our own citizens, to say nothing of the long string of the use of our military on the behest of transnational corporations and groups like the World Bank and the IMF to overthrow government leaders that we didn't like, including the prior president of Iraq. We tried to use Saddam Hussein to get to assassinate him. He failed, but we took him out anyway. So you supported that first Gulf War without giving some context on who put him there. We were just fine when he was doing our bidding. We know he had chemical weapons because we helped him get them. And for a long period, our foreign policy has been bent on helping transnational corporations do their bidding. And
I understand the thrust of your point. Let me just respond. The reason I didn't mention it is because we don't see at all eye to eye on these matters. And obviously one has to look at each multinational corporation on a case-by-case basis, but by and large I see them as positive forces in the world, providing employment, moving investment, and so forth. Also, a lot of them carry out important projects of corporate social responsibility. So I don't subscribe to a across-the-board negative view of what it is corporations do or what or how they do it. Indeed, they, from my point of view, in many cases, they are engines of economic growth. They're engines of technology transfer, and all of that to me is, they're obviously providers of employment. So for me, all of that is positive. They don't drive American foreign policy. It simply isn't the case. I've now worked for four administrations, so I have some idea about how foreign policy is made. And the idea that corporations somehow dictate what it is the United States or other governments do is simply not an accurate portrayal of, how foreign policy or national security policy more broadly is made. I could give a much longer answer, but I think the gap between us, quite honestly, is so wide that I'm not sure it would be a terribly good use of the limited time we have.
Great. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Vineet Sharma with the Hindu American Foundation.
Dr. Haas, thank you very much. I wanted to bring in the idea of religion and foreign policy. You have stated in the article we need to pull back a little bit from the Middle East, especially militarily. But what I want to discuss is the ideas that are promoted by a foreign policy establishment. And one of the ideas that seems that's unknowingly promoted and validated is the idea of Islamism. And this is done by almost all the foreign policy makers, including President Obama, when they refer to the Islamic world as a political entity that can be reached out to. This only validates the ideas of extremist groups that nation states should be based on religion, particularly Islam. So U.S. foreign policy, do not reach out to the Christian world, the Jewish world, the Buddhist world, but they do reach out to the Islamic world. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on whether this is justifiable or should be changed. It seems we should reach out to states or political entities that can be held accountable.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting question. The United States, for example, though, we do reach out to groups like the OIC, the Islamic Conference, in the same way that we have, diplomatic representation at the Vatican, which is the seat, obviously, of authority for Catholics. So I don't think it's totally unique. Second of all, I think it's simply a fact, if you want to call it political Islam, is a force to be reckoned with. It operates, within countries of the Middle East and elsewhere. And I think we'd be naive if we simply dismissed it. It represents something of a fusion of the religious and political. In some cases, it's pursued totally within the traditional political process. In other cases, it's pursued in with violence. In some cases, its goals are relatively moderate. In some cases, its goals are relatively radical or extreme. I just think we've got to take it into account. We've got to be careful in how we phrase things. We've got to be careful in how we differentiate from situation to situation. So it's something of a, I'll be honest, it's something of a rhetorical and political minefield. It calls for considerable, sensitivity and accuracy. But I do think there's something somewhat different going on, and I just think it behooves us to deal with it in a way that hopefully, reflects the reality, and also does it in a way that it doesn't make difficult situations that much more difficult. But I don't think, on the other hand, we can simply ignore it and say that there's not something in some cases going on that is qualitatively different.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Simi Ahmed with the Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you, Dr. Haas, for your talk, and I look forward to reading your book. I was just wondering what your thoughts are regarding the situation in Burma right now, the human rights abuses going on, and especially in light of the visit by the Burmese president. He's visiting President Obama. So do you think the United States should ignore what's going on, you know, in light of the improved relations between the U.S. and Burma after a long, long time? Do you think we should ignore it? And if not, what do you think the U.S.'s role should be in this, if any?
Let me say a couple of things. Let me preface it by saying I'm not an expert, so if I speak at a certain level of generality, it's not because I'm avoiding what you say, it's just that I know what I don't know. Look, the whole set of developments in Burma over the last couple of years, quite honestly, took almost all of us, at least who are not experts, as a surprise. And I think it probably took some of the experts as a surprise that there was what seemed to be as much progress as there was in so short a time. And now I think it's fair to say that there are certain questions being raised about how extensive and how enduring that progress actually has been or will be. To answer your question, no, I don't think the United States should ignore it. I don't think we should give up in any way on Burma, and I don't think we should stop trying to be a voice and a proponent of a continued opening up of Burma, both, you know, becoming fully politically independent, but also becoming more politically and economically open. Now, exactly what are the best ways to help nurture all that? That's a level of knowledge and expertise beyond what I have. But I think the fact that you have a visit here is all in all a good thing. It gives us a chance privately and publicly to make the case for what we believe is right and what is wrong, and it gives us the chance to make the case publicly and privately for what we think ought to be done by the people within Burma. Obviously, it's their right to decide what it is they will do. You know, we're not in a position to impose. We're not in a position to order anybody to do anything. On the other hand, we are in a position to adjust our policy according to how people there act in ways vis-a-vis principles and interests that we hold to be important.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sharif Zafar with NCTC.
Hi, Dr. Austin, Sharif Zafar. I do a lot of mentorship with young people, and it seems like, you know, you're talking about, you know, there's issues in more economic policy, which transcends foreign and domestic, there's foreign policy, and then there's core domestic policy issues that are all converging. So if there's a young person who wanted to make an impact in this, you know, along the lines of the issues that you identify are key in it, but what would you recommend for him or her? You know, what would you study? What fields would you recommend they go into?
Well, there's so many ways to make an impact. In terms of what to study, I think it is important, as we discussed before, to get the basic tools of what you might call literacy in the literal sense, abilities to read, to write, to think analytically, to understand math, science, technology, essentially to get the basics. And then I would hope people would also get at least a foundation of content about economics, about history, about politics, just so they have the tools. Where they focus doesn't really, to me, matter much. It doesn't matter to me whether someone ends up being a foreign policy expert or an expert on infrastructure or education. If he or she chooses to be a teacher or an engineer, whether they go into the army or become a religious leader. I mean, there's the details, if you will, of involvement in terms of the subject matter or the occupation are, to me, secondary. That's obviously a matter for individual choice. What I just want is for people to to get involved, to do some initial education. I'd say one other thing, though, since you raised it, which is the importance of seeing education is lifelong. We're talking about, say, young people getting a foundation in education, but then they're going to probably be working, given the kinds of lifespans we have now, for the next 40 or 50 years. And in that 40 or 50 years, say from the ages of their early 20s to their mid to late 60s or early to mid 70s, they may have, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 different jobs. It's inconceivable, given the rate of technological innovation, given global competition and all the rest, that any education, I don't care if it's Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, or Yale, that any education they got when they turn 21 is going to be enough to see them through for the next 40 or 50 years. And for those who didn't have the luxury or opportunity to go to Harvard or Princeton or Stanford or Yale, that's even more the case. So we're going to have to think about education differently, and not simply as something you do when you're young, but something that you do on and off constantly throughout your life, often to facilitate new employment or to simply make you more capable so you could hopefully be better as a parent or as a citizen or what have you. So I really think that we need to reimagine, if you will, or reconceive how we understand education and move away from the model which we now have, where education is something almost solely done for young people, and think of it our lives and throughout our careers, and the specifics of what we learn will obviously change. There's probably stuff we're all going to need to know in 30 or 40 years that we can't even imagine, in the same way that no one 25 or 30 years ago could imagine that something called an iPad or an iPhone. The technology is changing at a rate and to a degree that is unimaginable. What we want to give people are the tools so they can understand and absorb and make use of whatever new technologies come along.
Well, with Richard, with that, I think we've reached the end of our hour. Unfortunately, I know we have others waiting on a line, and I apologize for not having gotten to you. But we appreciate your taking the time to be with us, Richard.
Well, thank you, and I thank everybody for tuning in and staying with us for so long. I appreciate it.
Thank you all for your great questions and comments. As a reminder, Dr. Haas's book is available on Amazon.com. I hope you'll take a look at it. Foreign Policy Begins at Home. And you can read more of his op-eds and analysis on our website, www.cfr.org. As you know, this conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, seeking to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars in conversations on a broad range of international issues. We appreciate any feedback or suggestions you may have and ask that you email us at outreach@cfr.org. So thank you all again.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.